Hi, this is Amira Adawi, your host of Beauty and Wellness Talk podcast. This podcast is intended to raise awareness on the issues of colorism, skin lighting practices, chemical exposures, as well as empowering communities and improving the health literacy of communities of color. We have many different guests that talk about issues that are around colorism, and the intersection of public health, environmental justice, and empowering communities overall. For the last few weeks, we have been covering stories around lived experience of colorism. And today, we will be interviewing Safiya Mohammed, who is also who also was the Young Women's Wellness and Leadership Initiative part of cohort one. And I will be interviewing her today on her lived experience of colorism. Hi, Safiya. Welcome to Beauty and Wellness Talk podcast. I have interviewed you before through our radio show, Beauty and Wellness Talk radio show, and now we have a podcast. So welcome again to our radio show and podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
Yes, thank you. So Safiya, can you introduce yourself, what you do, who you are, what you do?
Yeah, so my name is Safiya Mohammed. I am a first year student at the University of St. Thomas. I am studying journalism and double minoring in justice and peace studies and theology. And I'm involved in a number of activities on campus. I serve as a reporter for Tommy Media, which is the student news organization. And I also work in my university student diversity office in a number of digital marketing campaigns to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's amazing, Safiya. You must be very busy.
Oh, I am.
Yeah, that's great. Very proud of you, the work you do, as well as your education. So welcome to our podcast. So our discussion today will focus on lived experience of colorism, particularly your lived experience of colorism. And so I will start with a question that I mostly ask people. How do you define colorism?
I define colorism as a
in your
preference.
Own
words. Yeah. Yeah, so in my own words, I define colorism as a preference for lighter skin over darker skin tones. And I believe that it is something that transcends just personal prejudice. It is something that is embedded in the beauty industry, in the workforce, in even marriage and in people's personal lives. It's a systemic issue, and it is one that goes hand in hand with racism. It's a byproduct of racism, essentially.
Mm-hmm. That's really great way to put. Thank you for sharing that, Safiya. So Safiya, what's your lived experience of colorism? You know, all of us, people of color, especially Blacks, have experienced, have had multiple events of colorism, all of us, whether it's direct or indirect. Could you share your lived experiences of colorism? I know it's not one experience, it's multiple experiences. So please share with us.
Well, I remember growing up, I was always considered dark skin. I am a dark skinned woman, but my aunts and female family members would always make it a point to really point it out. And they said it in ways that was very backhanded and insidious. For example, my younger sister is much lighter than me, so they would always compliment her on her light skin. And she gets those features from my mom, and I get my darker features from my dad. And it always, I felt really bad about it. I felt put down. And I always felt like I was the black sheep among, in comparison to my sister. So that made me feel really alienated and insecure. And that was the kind of rhetoric that I was around growing up. I also remember distinctly that a lot of my just female family, not a lot, but I had aunts and female family members that would use skin lighting products, as a result from colorism and wanting to be lighter because that is considered desirable in our community. And I had a couple of conversations with my mom about that, but it always went on, it went like, oh, these women are just doing this because it's just something that they do, don't really think much about it. It's like makeup. But I was never really interested in it because even though I felt insecure in my own skin, I never wanted to take such drastic measures. And that's sort of how it played out in my life growing up as a child.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's experience that I am sure many young people share with you who have darker shade and either came from our culture or other cultures as well. It's very common experience. What other experiences have you had?
Well, I have talked about this with my friends as well, and we've shared stories and have found similarities amongst ourselves within each of our stories. And it's honestly how I got through it, talking with my friends about my insecurity of being darker skin. And even though it really took a toll on me, I was able to find solace amongst other young Somali girls and other women of color. I would say that I'm very fortunate in the sense where those insecurities didn't stay for long. I know a lot of people, when they're told you're too dark, you're not pretty enough because you're not light, it stays with them for a really long time. And unfortunately, they might result into using skin lighting and skin whitening creams. I was able to break that cycle at a young age because I got support from my friends, and because of social media, I was online, as a Gen Zer, and I would come across stories and posts by other Black women and other women of color who were confident in their hue and were unapologetic about it. And I am very fortunate to have come across that at a young age because it essentially helped me get out of the funk that I was in. And it made me realize that my skin is beautiful just the way it is. So even though I came from a place of, oh, I'm not pretty enough because I'm dark, that idea did not stay with me for long.
So what were some of the tools that you have learned from your friends or the coping mechanism that helped you to actually be happy of who you are and embrace your skin color?
Well, a couple of things that helped me from within my friend circle was I'm very lucky to have really good supportive friends, close friends, and they were able to affirm me and remind me that my skin is beautiful just the way it is. I don't need to compare myself to lighter skinned women, and I don't need to let what other older folks in our community say. I shouldn't let that get to my head. And outside of my friendship circle, I again was a stumbled across women of color, Black women within the beauty industry who were shattering the glass ceiling and getting onto runways, making it to magazine covers, being on TV, winning the awards, and doing so many other things, trailblazers essentially. And seeing them in all different shades of melanin and having them serve as people to look up to and within our community, it really, really changed the course of my thinking. And on social media, there would be campaigns of, Melanin Monday, loving our skin, Black is beautiful, and mantras like that would really also contributed to me getting past the negative thoughts that were ingrained and fed to me as a child. And it really helped me establish a more better connection with my skin tone and my Blackness.
Mm-hmm. That's really great and powerful. Thanks for sharing, Sophia. With your friends, were they also experiencing similar things?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. They were, well, my friends are, you know, all sorts of shades, and yeah. They, some of them, especially the ones who were very light, they didn't receive any of those criticisms at all. Mm-hmm. They were always complimented by aunts and told, oh, you're so pretty. Oh, you know, Ade, which means like, you know, little pretty light-skinned one in Somali, and they'd always get compliments. So they never really understood my experience, but they could empathize.
Mm-hmm.
And with my darker skin friends, they understood where I was coming from because they too had gone through the same thing. And we compared our, we've talked about this a lot, and we've compared our experiences and the ongoing pattern of being told that you're not beautiful or being recommended in a, such a sly manner to use lightening creams from aunts, and you know, just being told, oh, don't go into the sun, things like that, that really tore us down and made us feel worse and bad about ourselves, especially as young women.
Mm-hmm.
Talking yeah. about it really did serve as a space to heal from that and to get through it together, form a alliance of some sort.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sophia. So, Sophia, have you ever had a conversation with your aunts or your relatives or even members, older members in the Somali community to see, you know, the words that they, you know, like to learn more about the words that they use and why mm-hmm. that, where is that even coming from?
Mm-hmm. So I've talked to one of my aunts about it, and she's very much against it. She thinks that it's just a terrible practice, and she's always like, oh, I have no, I do not understand why people do it. The psyche and the mentality behind it, I just don't get it. And we're sort of on the same page, so it's really easy to discuss this kind of stuff with her. But with my, with the other women in my life and in my family, I haven't really been able to, you know, strike a conversation with them, because it's, even though it's very common, skin lightening is very common.
Mm-hmm.
It is a taboo topic. Nobody really wants to talk about the fact that they use whitening creams to look the way they look and alter their features in that way. Nobody wants to discuss it. And that stigma has sort of also been passed down to me as well, where I don't really talk about it with too many older folks within the community, but there is the one aunt that I have that I'm able to have these conversations with.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right. It's a very stigma, but at some point, you know, we need to make sure that people have these conversations
mm-hmm.
that, you know, and that we combat it all together to make sure that people are comfortable discussing about, you know, why people are even feeling this way and be open to what, you know, they have been experiencing mm-hmm. and how they want to come, how they want eventually to either stop these products or address the colorism that they're experiencing. So Sophia, I know you do a lot of activism in terms of addressing, you know, discrimination and racism, and I'm sure there's a reason why you do that. So could you talk about why you do that and where does your activism stem from?
My activism stems from a lot of places. So I am a writer. I've been writing for as long as I can remember. And I've always felt that my message is strongest when it is in a written form, as opposed to verbally communicating it. So I use my reporting and writing skills as tools of advocacy. And my advocacy stems from, sorry, Amira, could you pause it for a second? So my advocacy stems from me wanting to raise awareness about the issues within my community, and specifically tying that with colorism. I see it as such a rampant systemic problem within my family and within the wider Somali East African community and so many other communities of color. And I believe that by writing and getting the word out, getting the message out, and raising awareness about this through journalism and through reporting, I'm doing my part in creating change and raising more awareness about colorism, but also instilling confidence and security within other young girls of color who have probably been told the same things that I was told growing up, but also need to hear the message that they are more than enough and their skin is beautiful just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Sophia. So Sophia, could you talk about more about, you know, what helped you? Let's start with this. How do you identify yourself? What's your ethnicity? And when people ask you, who is Sophia? How do you define that?
So I am Somali. I identify as Somali. I identify as a Black woman, a Black Muslim woman, a woman of color. I like to call myself a multi-hyphenated person because I have many intersecting identities, and each play a role in my lens of how I view this world and the work that I do as a reporter and as a journalist. And I think each is important, and wherever I go, I bring all of those identities with me.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So when was the time that you learned about your identities? Was it like when you were very young or recently? Like, when was the time that you were able to actually think about different identities and how you formed that?
So in middle school, well, even going farther back in elementary school, I was one of the only Somali and Muslim, one of the only kids of color in my elementary school. And I felt very alienated and different because I stood out from everyone else. And I knew from a very young age that I was different as a result of my experience. And as I got older, as I entered middle school, I learned the nuances behind the fact that I was different and what it meant to be the only person of color in the room, what a person of color even was, and how that related to me and the systemic barriers that I would face. These weren't conversations that I would have with my family. It was something that I had to learn on my own. I learned through experience that I was different and through talking with my other friends of color. Mm-hmm. And that prompted me to want to learn more about my identity as a Black woman, as a woman of color, as a Muslim woman, and to learn more about my background. And it set me on a journey to explore those things and how they're woven together, but what they mean within their respective lanes. And it's really shaped how I view this world. And now, being in college at a predominantly white institution, I definitely think that thinking about these things at a really younger age really laid a foundation of security. And also knowing that now that I'm in higher education and when I enter the workforce, not a lot of people are going to look like me, but I have the tools and the skills and the assets to be able to continue and persist despite those barriers.
Yeah, thanks, Sophia, for sharing that. Could you talk about your experiences and you were born in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Your experiences of going through public school in United States.
So as I mentioned before, I went to a predominantly white elementary school. I remember in my first grade, I was one of three Somali students and one out of a handful of students of color. And it was a gifted and talented school. So it was very selective, and if it was full of a lot of upper class rich white kids who came from prestigious families who, you know, essentially were more involved in their kids' lives than my family was.
Mm-hmm.
And we just came from such different worlds where even at a young age, I picked up on the fact that I was different from my classmates, and they picked up on it as well. Mm-hmm. And there were moments where our differences would cause a lot of division, and I felt alone, and I felt as if nobody could relate to me. And those feelings stuck with me for a really long time. It's what prompted me to later on learn about identity and intersectionality and all of that. But mm-hmm. within those moments in elementary school and in the public school system, I remember it just really tainted my childhood, and it wasn't a good experience overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. For sharing that. Could you talk about your experiences in terms of, you know, teachers? Like, did they understand colorism at the time when you were going through public school systems? Or were they even able to identify what colorism is within the school settings?
Not at all. They did not understand any of that. I feel that because I went to a predominantly white elementary school,
mm-hmm.
we never talked about race. We never talked about racism. We never talked about colorism. We never talked about identity, background, any of that. We didn't even acknowledge Black History Month. We only acknowledged Dr. Martin Luther King, but it never really went beyond that. So because we never talked about race and the fact that people are different, mm-hmm. it caused a lot of hostility between my teachers and I, especially since I felt as if I couldn't open up to them about my experience of feeling alone.
Mm-hmm.
And they never really provided the safe space or comfort for me to come to them and say, hey, I don't feel at home here, or I don't feel like I have a place. It was a lack of communication. And on their part, they didn't really know how to interact with a student of color, a Somali student, a Muslim student. So they didn't really know how to comfort me or try to create an inclusive classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's experience that many young girls have shared with me. Mm-hmm. Failure of teachers acknowledging either race or skin color. Does that impacted your education, or have you heard young girls at the time who were also from communities of color experiencing similar thing?
Yeah, so I talked to a lot of other, well, not at the time, but as I got older and met more Somali kids, more people of color who were also probably some of the only students of color in their classrooms and in their school, they also had similar experiences of feeling alienated and having teachers that even contributed to their alienation and to the discrimination they faced. And it's a complex system of so many factors and people that uphold it that make students of color feel unwelcomed and unwanted in school and in especially elementary school as kids. And it's something that I've talked to a lot of my friends who've experienced similar things as well. And it's definitely something that should be addressed, because we shouldn't wait until we get older to be able to talk about it. We should have the tools and the resources and also the support and the love and care from the teachers, so that we don't have to even go through it to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think some of these solutions can be, like ways that can be addressed?
Well, I would say trainings for teachers, diversity trainings, inclusion trainings, making sure that teachers are culturally competent and know how to interact with students of color, know how to create inclusive classrooms, know how to root out racism and discrimination, because what we see today, a lot of the prejudice and a lot of the systemic racism, it all starts at a very young age. So it's on teachers to be able to root that out from, you know, from when a kid begins kindergarten and goes on up. And I would also say it's not only on teachers, it's on faculty members and principals and all the other people that work within the school and within the school system it's on them to create the steps and the foundations for us to get to a better place and to make sure that students of color feel welcomed and feel like they belong, as opposed to feeling like they don't belong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important. So when did that change? Did that change when you came to high school level, or it stayed the same?
It got better in high school in some aspects. Mm-hmm. So for high school, I had a couple of teachers that were very, very supportive and really uplifted me and shaped me into the person that I am today. I felt very supported by them. I felt really safe and comfortable around them. And then there were teachers who really reminded me of my elementary school teachers. They had a lot of blind spots. They were very unaware of a lot of issues that students of color faced. And some of them even contributed to the problem, in the sense that they would be more disrespectful and more combative with their students of color over their white students, or they would have preferences and pick favorites with their white students over their students of color. And I feel, because I went to such a big high school, I went to Central High School, and with over 2,000 students, you kind of get a mix of everyone. There were all sorts of teachers there. Mm-hmm. But I would say, in a more general sense, things weren't really that different. But in my experience, in my personal experience, it was a bit better than elementary school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good to hear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So were there any examples of you experiencing colorism in school settings? I know you have shared, you know, some of the, you know, identity issues, but has there been any incidents that happened, if you remember, about colorism, either towards you or somebody else?
Yes. So I think a lot of my negative experiences with racism and colorism in high school came in the form of microaggressions. Mm-hmm. It came from students who, whenever I took advanced classes, I was usually in class with a lot of white students. And a lot of those students would just be very hostile and unapproachable, in the sense where you would get the vibe of, oh, we don't want to associate ourselves with this person. We're going to do everything in our power to exclude this person. But it was very subtle, in a very passive aggressive Minnesotan way. Mm-hmm. So there was that culture of hostility from white students. And from teachers, you got the same thing as well, but you also got the feeling that you were not supported in taking part in those classes. And whenever I was struggling, there were some teachers, the ones who I experienced those microaggressions from, who just wouldn't really help me in the way that I needed. And even if I advocated for myself, I still wouldn't get the help that I deserved as a student.
Mm-hmm.
So that was also very challenging to navigate. And with school counselors, with my school counselor, I personally felt as if there were moments where they would discourage me from taking certain classes. And I talked about this with other students of color who had that counselor, and they also experienced the same thing of being discouraged, being told, I don't think a student like you should be in a class like this. Very much passive aggressive behavior, microaggressions. And it all, those components really, really, they hit a nerve in the sense where I felt like I didn't belong. And I really struggled to stand up for myself, especially when it's something that's so rampant and it keeps coming from all ends.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it comes from a teacher, someone who's a faculty member who's supposed to support you.
Yes.
But I found ways to navigate it and to get through it. And I was able to advocate for myself and for my peers of color as well. And thankfully, it all worked out in the end.
Mm-hmm. That's sad. And, you know, it's really sad that also many young people are still experiencing that. You know, I remember one time I was a guest speaker in one of the public schools here in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember the teacher sharing with me that, you know, I think it was more of a comment / question about advanced classes, you know, like immigrant students from different countries, even if they mm-hmm. were born here in the United States, them struggling with the advanced classes. Mm-hmm. Or either not going to the advanced classes, especially the English. And so like now you sharing your experience kind of reminds me her comment about that and she meant it in a really good way to mm-hmm. like how do we help kind of them succeeding and doing well in advanced courses. So mm-hmm. so if the students don't have support when they're taking these advanced courses, they're not gonna do well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is exactly what you are sharing now, that mm-hmm. you didn't even have support system when you were taking your advanced courses.
Yeah, it was really hard to navigate it because I felt that if I wanted support, I had to go out and find it for myself. I had to advocate for myself, which I have no problem doing.
Yeah.
But I had to really push teachers and faculty to really get them to the table and tell them, hey, this is what I need. I had to convey to them my needs. And in some moments, it came out of a place of desperation where I was at the end of my rope and I didn't really know who to go to. And it just sort of all inflated and just burst out. But I feel as though the other students of color who are in the same position as me really served as support. And they served as the support and the help and comfort, but also the security that I needed that I wasn't getting from teachers and from certain teachers and faculty.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm glad you mentioned about, you know, advocacy and self, you know, advocacy. Mm-hmm. That's very important, especially mm-hmm. Here in the United States, where you have to advocate all the time if you're a person mm-hmm. of color, issues that impact you or your communities. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very common thing. And it's very important that, you know, young people have these skills and ways to do. Sophia, where did you learn your you know, advocacy skills from, or is that something that you just had to teach yourself in order to survive?
It is definitely something that I had to teach myself. Growing up, I was a very shy, quiet person. I never really stood up for myself or spoke in class. I really kept to myself and never said anything, kept my head down, all of that. But as I entered high school and as I got older and was really put into situations where I had to speak up or else things would really go left, I learned how to use my voice and articulate my point. And I would also say that my journalism and reporting also helped me develop those advocacy skills, because advocacy isn't only something that's verbal. It can come in many different forms and takes so many different forms as well. Mm-hmm. I use writing and reporting as a tool for advocacy. And now that I'm in college, I'm trying to translate a lot of those skills over to verbal communication and use my words as opposed to my writing, which both are very important, but I'm trying to develop my verbal communication, my verbal advocacy. But I would definitely say that it's something that I've had to learn along the way.
Mm-hmm. That's really great. And I'm glad that you have mentioned different ways of advocacy and mm-hmm. how people can use that. It's not only, you know, to mm-hmm. just talk. You know, some people are introverted, and so mm-hmm. they have introverted personality. So talking might not be their style. And so writing is another way of, you know, advocacy. So that's an excellent point. So what mm-hmm. What do you think that, you know, like young people in terms of advocacy, what other tools, or like how can they learn like how can they find networks that support them? You know, a lot of times, you know, that representation is very difficult, mm-hmm. you know, and resources, you know, it's so difficult, like unless mm-hmm. somebody shares with you and tells you this program is happening or this network is going on, like nobody you wouldn't know. And so like mm-hmm. especially for young people of color who are already navigating these multiple, you know, systems that you know, that have so much institutional racism and mm-hmm. yeah, so what tools will you share with these young people?
I would say to the young people who are looking to develop advocacy skills and find their voice, I would say that they should hone in on one skill that they're good at. Could be anything, could be planning, it could be their ambition, it could be something more tangible. Just hone in on that one skill and perfect it, and find people that also have that one skill that could be of assistance in terms of developing it, and also can connect you with others who have that skill, and essentially it will broaden your expertise, but also broaden your network as well. That's a more broader response, but I also want to add that talking to peers and talking to people that are from your background, from your community, hold the same identity that you hold, or hold a marginalized identity, but sort of have the same parallel experiences that you do, speaking to them and forming solidarity with them and letting each other know that you've all got each other's backs also really helps, because a lot of the times advocacy is seen, well, in larger society, things are very individualistic, but with advocacy, it comes from a place of knowing that I am not at a good place unless the person next to me is at a good place, and unless this other person is at a good place, and unless all of us are in a better place. So caring about the well-being of others really helps developing advocacy tools, because once you fight for others and put their needs first, but prioritize their needs, you will essentially know how to fight for yourself as well.
Yeah, that's very well put, Sophia. That's really great advice. Thanks for sharing that. And you know, in terms of colorism, and you know, the work that we do is, you know, to combat colorism and, you know, address, you know, this whole cycle of skin lighting practices. And I see, you know, that, you know, one of the ways that we can break this cycle is to intervene young girls when, you know, young girls when they're very young, to make sure that they don't, you know, fall into eventually developing some of these negative feelings and then using these products is eventually. So what are the things that young people can do to dismantle colorism?
I would say, again, talking to your peers, talking to the people within your network and within your friend group, raising awareness about this word to mouth, and talking about it with as many people as you can, creating those conversations, fostering those conversations is the first step. But the next step after that is to talk to people who do practice it. So the aunties and the cousins and the people in our community that you know are actively promoting this, speaking to them, raising that awareness, and getting to that level where we can tell them that what they're doing is not necessarily the right thing to do. It's not okay. And making sure to affirm within all of our circles and with all people that we come across that their skin color is beautiful and there is no need for them to change it or to think of themselves as less than because of what society tells them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Sophia, for sharing that. These are very important points. What about, Sophia, the systems that promote this, like the media? You're a journalist person. Mm-hmm. What is the role of journalism in addressing this issue? Because obviously there are some media people that still promote colorism, as you are well aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say the media's role is to, first off, the media needs to be diversified, ground up. There's just so many problems with diversity, lack of diversity, and just the homogenous culture that upholds it needs to be dismantled. Let's start there. With regards to colorism specifically, I would say that a lot of journalists that are aware of the issue and have the ability to tell the stories to help dismantle the system of colorism should absolutely tell it, whether that be talking to advocates and community organizers that are dismantling colorism and raising awareness about it within communities of color, or whether it be companies that promote the practices and create the products, holding them accountable, interviewing those folks, really pressuring them to tell us why they think this is okay, or talking to politicians that are trying to rewrite laws that will prevent people from using these harmful products. I think that journalists should absolutely tell the stories of how it impacts people and do as much as they can to get the word out and raise awareness about colorism and the different avenues that it affects and the different avenues that it takes in terms of how it is promoted, but also the different avenues of what is being done about it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Thank you, Sophia. So, Sophia, for your last word, what do you, we're towards the end of the podcast interview. Mm-hmm. So what will you like to share with young people? Any of your last words?
I would say to young people, listening to this, and to young people all over the world, to be resilient and tenacious. I know that we face a lot of barriers, a lot of systemic obstacles, a lot of things in our path that may hinder our progress or try to tear us down and break us down. But those obstacles and those challenges only make us stronger. And we should have a firm grasp on what we want to do and do everything in our power to keep that goal of ours and within our grasp and to continue to fight for it. And I would also say that there is strength in numbers, that we can't achieve equality and change and foster this and create the world that we want to live in. We can't do that alone. We have to partner with each other. We have to create solidarity. We have to be there for one another, because collective community and collective efforts are always, always more impactful than the efforts of one individual alone.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing. And that is so right, Sophia. Collective communities and mm-hmm. collective, individuals and people coming together to address issues. That's very important. And thanks, Sophia, for sharing your words today mm-hmm. and your lived experience of colorism. And it's just so amazing how you overcame all of that, and you know what you're doing, your advocacy, your journalism work. It's just so amazing, and I am very proud of you. So thanks for doing what you do, and keep doing that.
Yeah, thank you for having me.